Good evening and welcome to Dialect Radio for Sunday, the 27th of June. This week we hear about a documentary called Invisible Empire, The New World Order Defined. US talk show host Alex Jones talks a bit in it, and it's a film by Jason Burmes. You can watch it on the internet, and it's all about conspiracy. It claims to prove, beyond doubt, how the elite have openly conspired to insidiously rule the globe via various international institutions. Tony Gosling is producing this week's show, so there is a certain theme where we're going to be hearing from David Southwell. His book, we're going to have Malcolm Grieve reading another episode of that, of Secrets and Lies, and this week it's Suppressed Data. I chat to Tony Gosling about why the Bristol coroner has been suspended. It's for 14 or 15 months now. We also hear from Michael Jackson, who's been dead for nearly a year now. This is a recording of him talking about corruption in the music industry and Mariah Carey. Eagle-eared listeners with a long memory will remember us talking about the Fisherman's Mission a very long time ago. A chap named Tim Moat came in, who is the regional organiser of the charity. And we hear another story about the Fisherman's Mission from Tim. We've also got Jeff Sparks doing the What's On guide and some tunes to pass the time. Well, I'd like to hand over now to Tony Gosling. Hello.
Hi, John.
So the Bristol coroner has been suspended. Why is this significant news?
Well, it's not really news because it happened around about 14, 15 months ago. It's just that it's really extraordinary that, first of all, that this has gone on for such a long time. You imagine if you were in your job and then suspended for 15 months, it would be a little bit strange for you. And also that there's been absolutely no explanation as to why he has been suspended. There are all sorts of rumours flying around, but no official word anywhere.
Right.
The responsibilities of our coroner are to hold inquests into all suspicious deaths in Bristol, including any where negligence could be a factor. And it's actually very difficult to get a coroner suspended or sacked because it's historically been a job with a lot of pressure on it. And it's possible, you know, if there are things like assassinations going on, that a coroner will actually be removed. At least that's what's happened in the past, which is why he's got such a secure job and why this is such a strange state of affairs. His name's Paul Forrest, and he was removed from his post and suspended on full pay by Bristol City Council's chief executive Jan Ormeroyd 14 months ago. The reasons for his suspension have not been made officially clear at all, but are thought to relate to Mr. Forrest speaking out publicly about the enormous inquest backlog, with corpses piling up literally at a temporary site at Southmead Hospital, waiting for the part privatised mortuary at Flaxbourton to be ready. Several years ago, Bristol City Council sold our city centre coroner's court to the Lakota nightclub next door. A new Bristol coroner's court opened shortly after the previous one closed, in a small and inaccessible refurbished police station outside Bristol near Flaxbourton. And incidentally, there is no signposting to it from Flaxbourton Village at all. And inadequate mortuary facilities, certainly up until recently, and also no very little public transport facilities for anyone that wanted to get to an inquest to find the place.
Right.
So now the new mortuary's finally been opened, and one of the most well-publicised inquests recently held there was where the rotting corpse of a man was left undiscovered in a council flat for nearly a decade, despite city council official who went in to check the flat not noticing the corpse. Anyway, back to the suspended Bristol coroner Paul Forrest, because the decision over the coroner's future is in the hands of something called the Office for Judicial Complaints in London. The council has asked the Office for Judicial Complaints to conclude their review as soon as possible in the interests of all concerned. But 14 months and £100,000 on and counting of local taxpayers' money later, the process appears no nearer a conclusion. Now, I spoke to Rachel Collins at the Office for Judicial Complaints a couple of weeks ago and asked her several questions. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to answer a single one of them. This is I'll just go through some of the questions
she couldn't answer because of confidentiality or...
Well, this is what they say. But I think, you know, after 14 months, at least the public, the taxpayers of Bristol, deserve at least an answer to one of them. So anyway, the questions are as follows. How many complaints are there against Mr. Forrest? What are the complaints? Who made the complaints? Were any of the complainants directly involved in an inquest themselves? If so, which inquest? Were any of the complaints related to Mr. Forrest speaking out about the very recent, very long delays Bristol inquests taking place and inadequate mortuary facilities? Is Mr. Forrest the first coroner in the UK to be investigated by this Judicial Complaints Office. Are any of the complaints connected with the privatisation of Bristol's coroner's mortuary services? Which High Court judge is overseeing the process? Who is reviewing the case? Who is actually on the reviewing body? How long do complaints like this normally take? How long is this review expected to take? And this process has taken well over a year so far, so are there any constraints on how long Office of Judicial Complaints procedures are allowed to take to review a complaint?
And she refused to answer any of those questions.
And also, I've also asked her, will the review be made public? And that wouldn't be any, there was no answer to that question either. Neither was there an answer to the final question, which was, how can the public be confident in the result when the Office for Judicial Complaints review process is so secret? Well, Rachel Collins at the Office for Judicial Complaints, so far didn't answer any of those questions, but she did send me an anonymous statement. Following allegations regarding a number of financial and mismanagement issues, the Lord Chief Justice and Lord Chancellor decided in March 2009 that Mr. Forrest should be suspended pending the outcome of the investigation by the Office for Judicial Complaints.
Okay, so it appears that he may have behaved in some sort of misconduct manner or engaged in something possibly.
Yes, I mean, but they're not saying anything about what it might be, and they haven't for the last 14, 15 months. But anyway, that statement continues. The Lord Chief Justice and Lord Chancellor reached a view on this case in March 2009. Following a preliminary investigation by a circuit judge. Mr. Forrest was made aware of their decision at that time. In the light of further representations from Mr. Forrest, the Lord Chief Justice and Lord Chancellor agreed that an independent review body should be established to look into the case. The review body is chaired by a High Court judge and has three other members, a coroner and two lay members. The review body process continues, and Mr. Forrest remains suspended while the investigation continues. It would be inappropriate to comment further at this stage. So, if the Office for Judicial Complaints or Rachel Collins or anyone else do answer any of these questions, I'll let you know. It continues to remain a really extraordinary state of affairs to have your coroner suspended for such a long time with no proper explanation as to why.
Is there anyone standing in for him instead, then?
Yes, there's an assistant coroner or a deputy coroner. And also, Paul Forrest, it has to be said, it was reported at Christmas time, has also had two heart attacks whilst he's been on suspension. And I think, really, the taxpayers of the city deserve an explanation from the Chief Executive and from the Office for Judicial Complaints as to why this process has dragged on such a long time.
You're listening to Dialect Radio.co.uk.
Well, to get you in the mood for a piece later on, a recording of Michael Jackson talking about corruption in the music industry, this is a track called They Don't Really Care About Us. Yeah. That was Michael Jackson with They Don't Really Care About Us. Well, let's hear from that now, actually, while we're in the mood. This is Michael Jackson recorded talking about Mariah Carey and corruption in the music industry.
So, the way you get revenge is to try and destroy my album. But I've always said, you know, art, good art never dies. Thank you. I love Unbreakable. You know, and Tommy Mottola is a devil. I'm not supposed to say what I'm going to say right now, but I have to let you in on a secret. Please don't videotape what I'm going to say, okay? Turn that off, please. You know what? I don't mind. Tape it. Mariah Carey. After divorcing Tommy, came to me crying. Crying. She was crying so badly, I had to hold her. And she said to me that this is an evil man. And Michael, this man follows me, she said. He taps her phones. And he's very, very evil. And she doesn't trust him. And he is a horrible human being. And we have to continue our drive until he's terminated. We can't allow him to do this to great artistry. We just can't. I just want you to know I appreciate everything you've done. You've been amazing. You're so loyal, Diana. Everybody, Waldo, all the people here, I love you all. I love you. But still, I promise you, the best is yet to come.
Yes!
Promise.
Well, back in 2003, 7 years ago, that was a recording of Michael Jackson there. Well, our roving reporter, Anthony Page, is, busy roving, basically, around Eastern Europe, but this is a feature from her.
My aunt, Dooney, my mum is very down-to-earth, solid, rooted. My aunt, Dooney, saw my grandfather the day after he died sitting on the sofa. And saw him just sit, you know, saw his spirit. So it's quite normal in their house.
So have you ever seen anything?
No, but I felt things in the house in Ireland. And so is Gypsy, and so have three generations of the family felt something in one room over the course of 50 years. Oh. So there's definitely something in one of the rooms.
Tell us about your grandmother, because I'm fascinated.
She's
gifted milliner.
Gifted milliner, gifted illustrator, could draw anything, especially dogs, people quickly, very fast, you know, unerring line. Very wild, like, wore jeans, like, to the day she died.
Jeans
that her, you know, like, her generation wore, put together a lot of clothes that, you know, that other people in Ireland wouldn't have ever worn. You know, she'd probably should have been born in Paris, and always said to the family, go to Paris if you're artistic, or, you know, go to Berlin. And always encouraged you if you're artistic, whereas my parents don't.
Was she quite famous in Dublin?
No, she wasn't famous, but she was well known in the sort of smart circles for the clothes she made. But she stopped quite early because she married. So she wasn't famous, but she was, you know, very gifted. I mean, it was too hard for her. She wanted to get married.
So tell us about the auras when choosing the clothes.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, someone's aura or feel is, you know, sometimes people just know. Some people have got an instinct. They know immediately what, you know, I look at something or a wall or a thing, and I know what should, art should go in there. They know from the aura, the colour of someone, the sense of someone, what would look good on them, and it's a sort of unerring instinct. You know, it's always right. It's, some people have that
instinct.
It's a seeing thing. It's not a necessarily spiritual. It's a sort of sixth sense of colour and the mood of somebody. And their colouring, of course, physically, of their face and hair and their demeanour. Mm. So, you know, some people just, you know, I think everyone has this. It's just, you lose this, it gets batted out of you. And it's all through, it's just confidence.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Alexander McQueen, for example, had this gift.
Well, let's hope she's having a splendid time. Thank you very much to Anthea Page and all those involved in that feature. Conspiracy theories. Love them or hate them, most of us have an opinion one way or the other. Investigative journalist and historian David Southwell has been doing his best to get to the bottom of some of his favourite enigmas. In Secrets and Lies, he confirms the old saying that truth really is stranger than fiction when you take the time to scry out the hard facts behind the smokescreen of rumours and disinformation. David doesn't pretend to have all of the answers, but he has applied an investigative journalist's eye to many enigmas, modern and not so modern. And this week, we hear Malcolm Grieve reading a chapter entitled Suppressed Data.
Secrets and Lies, teased out by David Southwell. One of the biggest lies we have drummed into us in school is that everything we are being taught about science and nature is based on all the facts available. However, as anyone who has studied the works of Charles Fort can tell you, academics have a long history of excluding a vast range of amazing data just because it does not fit in with their neat theories. This suppressed data tends to reveal that we live in a much more mysterious universe than we are led to believe. The problem is that if evidence of a puzzle is hidden and we are deceived into thinking the correct answer has been established, the mystery is lost. The mystery is lost to us, and no one can ever attempt to find the real truth. As pioneering rebel scientist Dr. Jack Sarfati has pointed out, the public is not told the truth by many scientists because they themselves are unaware of the evidence that discredits the theories they continue to peddle. Once an orthodox view in science has been established, all you usually need to do to keep it dominant is to make life unpleasant for anyone who challenges it, as happened to Wilhelm Reich and Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. The established orthodoxy has suppressed open-minded questioning and free thought on subjects as familiar as Darwinian theory and general relativity, to the much stranger frontiers of quantum physics. Because some scientists seem to value being right much more than wanting to know the actual truth. Much more than wanting to know the actual truth. On a clear night, you can look into the sky and see dozens of artificial satellites journey across the heavens. The miracles of rocketry have made GPS, global communications and satellite TV so commonplace that we no longer possess a sense of wonder where they are concerned. In 1960, just 3 years after the USSR had won the first heat of the space race by putting Sputnik 1 into orbit, satellites were far from routine. When in February 1960 one of the stations that formed the North American Air Defense System picked up a radar echo of a new satellite, it sent panic throughout the US military. Not only did the intelligence agencies have no idea that the USSR had launched a new satellite, nothing in their reports on Soviet space activity suggested they had the capacity to place an object into polar orbit, or to launch something that was estimated to be in excess of 15 tons. The military scientists were horrified, since they were at least 4 years away from achieving polar orbits and getting payloads that large into space. The Soviets were also panicking. They had not launched the satellite and knew they were years away from being able to accomplish such a feat. They also knew the Americans could not do it either. The Americans nicknamed the satellite Black Knight after the British rocketry program, even though they knew it could not have been a UK-launched object either. No one knew where it came from, but it was definitely there. Scientists in the US, USSR and other countries such as Sweden tracked the mystery object for 3 weeks before it disappeared without a trace. The Black Knight satellite was a secret that could not be cracked, so no record of it was placed in the almanacs that record known satellite launches, and no further scientific research was carried out. The only people who continued to speculate over its origins were writers such as Philip K. Dick, who wrote stories about it, renaming it Valis, or Zebra. Of all the differences that scientists hold up to draw a distinction between animals and humans, language is the most cherished and most often used one. The orthodox scientific view is that humans have language, animals do not. On the basis of this, scientists have built up careers claiming that they have isolated the genetic mutation that gave us language. Everything from the explanation of why Neanderthals died out, some researchers claim they lacked the language gene, to the moral justification for experimenting on animals has been advanced on the basis that even our closest genetic relative, the bonobo, or pygmy chimpanzee, does not have our ability to use language. Against this background, it was always inevitable that when a bonobo chimpanzee called Kanzi, kept at Georgia State University, Atlanta, came up with 4 distinct sounds for the things closest to its heart, banana, juice, grapes, and the word yes, without being taught to do it, scientists would be quick to try and reassert the orthodox lie that it is impossible for apes to speak or use words like a human. Previously, when another chimpanzee called Washoe learned American Sign Language, scientists redefined language as being the ability to use syntax and not just words. However, not content with making up his own words, contrary to the leading theories of many primatologists, Kanzi went on to demonstrate his ability to construct sentences, another ability he should not have had, according to the majority of scientists, by selecting words from among 3,000 symbols stored on a touch-sensitive computer screen to build such basic sentences as, "I would like some grapes." Accepting apes have language would not only affect what it means to be human, but also whether we have the right to experiment on fellow sentient beings. One of the more generous denigrators of the work carried out at Georgia State University was Dr. Tom Sambrook, who said, "I doubt it signifies all it appears to. Were a 4-year-old child to use language in the way a chimpanzee uses it, we would consider it disturbed." When scientists want to keep a theory or anomalous piece of evidence out of the view of the mainstream world, their usual tactic is to ignore it and hope it'll go away. This usually works, as the non-scientists cannot ask questions about evidence they know nothing about. Once in a while, though, a scientist breaks ranks from the orthodox view and brings into the open a theory so controversial that a very public attack seems to be the inevitable consequence. When in 1981 Sir John Maddox, the editor of Nature, one of the most important scientific magazines in the world, wrote an article titled "Fit for Burning" about a book, it was a sure sign somebody had got the white coats all riled up. The book he suggested burning was A New Science of Life by Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, a British biology professor at Cambridge University. Maddox went on to describe the book as an infuriating tract not to be taken seriously, and an intellectual aberration. It was Sheldrake's theory in the book about what he called morphic fields, an invisible form of information that exerts an influence on biology and plays a key role in the development of self-organising systems, that caused Maddox to launch such an astonishing attack on a fellow scientist. Sheldrake packed his book with numerous examples of phenomena that backed his theory. However, his suggestion that there are intangible fields that help determine animal instinct and play a role in telling DNA what it should develop into only drew ridicule from his colleagues, despite fitting the observed facts far better than the previously established theories. One of Sheldrake's critics, Professor Stephen Rose of the Open University, declared morphic fields as rubbish and unnecessary. Sheldrake agreed to perform learning experiments on day-old chicks to back up his claims, but Rose refused to accept results that seemed to back his opponent. In the face of scientific rejection, Sheldrake left his position at Cambridge. Ironically, in the years since, almost all of the experiments into his work have proved that his theory has a high degree of validity. According to orthodox scientists, there is no such thing as a sixth sense. As humans, our only source of information about the world we inhabit comes from what we can touch, taste, smell, hear and see. Renowned skeptic James Randi even offered to pay out $1 million to anyone who can demonstrate psychic powers. If Randi was not as obsessed with his belief that all claims of psychic phenomena are simply standard magical tricks being used to accomplish allegedly paranormal feats, he might be writing out a large cheque to Dr. Alan Pegner of the School of Psychology at the University of Wales. Under rigorous laboratory conditions, Dr. Pegner tested a blind man who possessed a sixth sense that allowed him to recognise the emotion on faces. The 52-year-old test subject, known only as Patient X, had suffered two strokes which damaged the brain areas that process visual signals and left him blind. He was able to tell if a face was happy, sad, fearful or angry. While not able to determine the sex of a face, he consistently scored a much higher than chance success on guessing the emotion depicted on human faces. Neural scans showed the information was registering in an area of the brain other than the visual cortex. Patient X displayed neural activity in the right amygdala, an almond-shaped structure situated deep within the brain's temporal lobe that is known to be involved in the processing of non-verbal signs of anger, defensiveness and fear. The startling implications of the results of Dr. Pegner's experiments, that there is a secret process by which the brain receives information not related to the five senses, quickly triggered a backlash from certain other scientists who were not prepared to accept such a possibility. Attacks ranged from the media reporting of the results to suggestions that Patient X is not actually blind, despite the results of tests on his eyesight having been conducted by the Department of Neurology at the University Hospital Geneva.
That was one of our occasional extracts from David Southwell's book Secrets and Lies. Thank you very much to him for letting us read that live on air. And congratulations to him also. David Southwell just got married last week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Okay, well, to get us in a suspicious frame of mind, ready to hear about conspiracies, this is Suspicious Minds by Elvis Presley.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me when you don't believe a word I say? We can't go on together with suspicious minds, and we can build our dreams on suspicious minds. So if a friend I'm
Well, there he is in fine form, Elvis Presley, as he was back in the heyday, and that was Suspicious Minds. Invisible Empire, a documentary, is all conspiracy and no theory. It claims to prove beyond doubt how the elite have openly conspired to insidiously rule the globe via the engines of the CFR, the United Nations, the Trilateral Commission, and the notorious and infamous Bilderberg Group. It's a feature that's starring Alex Jones, who is a US talk show host, in case you don't know him. And this is a clip.
Nazi forces seek to establish systems of government based on the regimentation of all human beings by a handful of individual rulers who seek power by force.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society.
And the hope that each of us has to build a new world order.
A new world order is coming into being, but it looks less and less like the world order that Mr. Kissinger had constructed in his own mind.
And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
What is the Bohemian Grove? Well, it's a kind of summer camp for the powerful.
Among its members, political figures like Gerald Ford, President Reagan, Vice President Bush, Richard Nixon is a Bohemian. Each year, guests like Henry Kissinger or Zbigniew Brzezinski address members on their areas of expertise.
You'd be a poster child for these people because you have served on the board of the Council on Foreign Relations, you started, helped start the Trilateral Commission, and you've been to the Bilderberg groups.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy.
I don't believe in this notion of some sort of secret societies controlling people. But, of course, in any political system, there are sort of over-the-table and under-the-table arrangements.
It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine
by the military-industrial complex.
Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised.
We can find meaning and reward by serving some higher purpose than ourselves. A shining purpose, the illumination of 1,000 points of light.
No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
The quest for the new world order is in part a challenge to keep the dangers of disorder at bay.
We were interested today to hear that more than 100 law enforcement officials in Mexico are having microchips implanted in their arms. The chips allow a person to be scanned, sort of like a cereal box at the supermarket checkout.
I think the most important thing is for Barack Obama.
I think his task will be to develop an overall strategy for Americans in this period when really a new world order can be created.
I think a new world order is emerging, and with it the foundations of a new and progressive era of international cooperation.
But the burdens of global citizenship continue to bind us together. In this new century, Americans and Europeans alike will be required to do more, not less. Partnership and cooperation among nations is not a choice.
Yes, these men and their hypnotized followers call this a new order. It is not new, and it is not order.
I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people.
And that was a clip there from Invisible Empire, A New World Order Defined. The film traces the lineage of the evolution of global governance from Samuel Zane Batten's 1919 manifesto, New World Order, through to Hitler's vision for a thousand-year Reich, to the modern incarnation of the conspiracy, which has its roots in the evil deeds, if that's what you choose to believe, of people like George H.W. Bush, David Rockefeller, and Henry Kissinger. Invisible Empire catalogues the primary criminal enterprises through which the agenda is financed, operated and advanced: government-controlled drug running, false flag terror, banking scams and state-sponsored assassination. The film was made by a fellow named Jason Bermas, B-E-R-M-A-S. It's his film, and it's 2 hours and 15 minutes, and you can go to youtube.com/user/ change the channel, which is all one word, and that's the word change, followed by D-A, followed by channel, change the channel. Other websites, if this kind of thing tickles your fancy, you can go to and look up our infowars.com, info as in information, and the rather sort of negatively associated title prisonplanet.com, and also prisonplanet.tv. Those are the sort of places you can go if you like that kind of thing.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, here's a welcome return from a fellow who's an absolutely splendid guest. This is Tim Mert, who's the regional organiser of a charity called The Fisherman's Mission. This is on the back of sort of some recent themes that we've been doing in recent shows, talking about the SS Balmoral and various trips that you can do to the sea. So let's hear some a little bit more about this charity.
I'm Tim Mert, and I work for The Fisherman's Mission. I'm a regional organiser. That's to say, the largest part of my time is spent drumming up money.
Now, people might be reluctant to part with their money because, for many of us, we'd assume that there really are hardly any fishermen left.
Altogether, there's about 13,000 fishermen left, but there's about 50,000 on the beach or retired.
And so what does the mission actually do for those people?
Well, we're providing care and comfort for people in the fishing communities. So not just the fishermen, but all the people in those communities. And the help that we provide consists of physical, spiritual and financial support.
So let's start with the physical. What sort of physical support can you give?
We can look after someone who has physical needs. Now, in fact, some people from near here, near Bristol, provided some help to me during the course of this year. A ladies' group from a church got together a whole selection of knitted hats and pullovers and other woolies, and those have gone, part of them to Northern Ireland, part of them to Scotland, and they have been used by people from Latvia, Lithuania, as well as our own fishermen.
Okay, but what about sort of hostels and things like that? Have you got anywhere and you have any sort of care beds and things like that for fishermen who are ill? Or is it just things like, you know, items like this clothing and that kind of thing?
We have a different presence in different ports. In Brixham, in North Devon, for instance, we have quite a large mission, complete with showers, accommodation, a canteen and rest facilities for people who happen to be in that port. Likewise, in Newlyn being equally a large port from the point of view of the fishermen. Up in Scotland are the biggest ports of all, where there are very large accommodation centres. Altogether, we have about 30 staff in our ports. Many of them, though, are rather more like welfare officers. That's to say, they go around different small fishing communities, talking with and providing support to the families in those communities.
And what about spiritual support? I mean, how can you actually give spiritual support?
Well, the thing that most people would think of would be spiritual support in the sense of services, religious services. And we run a nightcap service in all the major mission centres. Some people tend to think of us as being like the Sally Army by the sea.
And so what happens? Does someone who's maybe in financial need or whatever just get in touch with you and say, look, I just need a little bit of money to help me through paying the rent or something like that?
Yes, we helped in about 1,000 cases last year, and the average support that we provided in financial terms was around £500. Very often, the support we might be providing to a family, though, would extend beyond that to the point of helping them to get through the grieving process for a loved one who has been severely injured or lost at sea.
So how far back does the Fisherman's Mission actually go?
1881 we were founded by Ebenezer Mather.
And who was he?
Ebenezer Mather was a cleric, a clergyman from Whitby, who was in London and was taken out by a friend to the Dogger Bank to see the fishermen at work. He was struck by their plight, and when he got back into port, he decided there and then he was going to fit out a boat with comforts and medicines and provide help to the people who were out at sea for perhaps weeks at a time in cold, open boats.
Okay, so, but does the Fisherman's Mission have any boats nowadays, or is it just land facilities you've got?
That changed around the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries. So round about in the period from 1900 to 19, till the Second World War, 1940, during that period, slowly but surely, the number of ships or boats that the mission had going out to help people in the fishing fleets, slowly but surely that reduced and was replaced by shore-based facilities, especially accommodation in those days, because the fishermen sometimes didn't have anywhere to stay when they came into port.
What about modern-day fishing, though? Surely it's in a rapid state of decline. And also, we often hear that stocks of fish are beginning to be actually fished out.
Right. I think it would be rash of me to try to offer words on the advisability or not of fishing and whether or not we are removing all of the livestock of the sea. Instead, what I would say is you look at the North Sea and what colour is it? Grey?
Sort of grainy, grey-greeny colour, I'd say.
And can you see through it?
No.
That's because it's chock full of plankton. So we may overfish one species, but it will simply be replaced by something else.
Okay, and what is the modern state of fishing? Is it still in decline? Because at least for the last 20 years, I know we keep hearing of fishing ports closing, some of them, and I suppose, I don't know what they're called, but they're gigantic boats taking over from where the trawlers left off.
Pelagic trawlers, largely. They are very large boats, maybe 200 feet in length, and fitted out with all mod cons so that a crew of perhaps a dozen people can spend months at sea on such a ship. However, coming back to your point, the overfishing, yes. It's not a case of overfishing. It's rather more that man's own ingenuity creates a challenge for people. Man's own ingenuity has meant that a modern boat catches 100 times as much as a boat crewed by the same number of people in 1950. We actually eat, on average, about 40 pounds of fish a year, each of us. In 1960, we ate about 25 pounds of fish each a year. In 1950s, 1960, a million tons of fish was produced by farming methods. Today, it's 50 million tons. In fact, the larger part of the fish we eat is produced through industrial farming rather than going out and catching wild fish. So it is certainly not true to say that we are fishing species to extinction in the general sense, nor that there will be no fish at some point in the future, like 2050. It just will not happen. Round the Bristol area, if you go down towards Somerset and North Devon, you will be able to see fishing communities, that's to say day fishing communities, in a number of places. You might choose to go to somewhere really picturesque, like Clovelly or Barnstaple and Biddeford. It might be that you wish to go on down into Cornwall and go to places like Padstow and Newquay. There are so many country.
Okay, finally then, can people find you on the internet, the Fisherman's Mission?
Yes. Just dial Fisherman's Mission into Google, you'll find us.
Well, just to prove that fishing isn't completely dead as an industry, that's Tim Mowat there, the regional organiser for the Fisherman's Mission. And I was very entertained to discover that the founder of it was called Ebenezer. What a splendid name, which put me in mood for Ebenezer Good by the Shaman.
Great philosopher once wrote, naughty, naughty, very naughty.
Face, and he goes by the name of Ebenezer Good. His friends call him Easer and he is the main geezer. And he vibe up the place like no other man could. He's refined, he's sublime, he makes you feel fine. They're very much maligned and misunderstood. But if you know Easer, he's a real crowd pleaser. He's ever so good, he's Ebenezer Good. You see that he's mischievous, mysterious and devious. When he circulates amongst the people in the place, once you know he's fun and something of a genius. He gives a grin that goes around face to face to face. Backwards and then forwards and then backwards. Easer is a geezer, he loves to muscle in. That's about the time the crowd has shouted the name of Easer. He's clutched in the corner laughing by the base bin. Anyone got any beers? Lovely. He's a good leading light of the scene, know what I mean? He created the vibe, he takes you for a ride, and this is by design. The party ignites like he's coming alive. He takes you to the top, shakes you all around and back down. You know as it gets mellow, then it's smooth as a groove that is making you move. He glides into your mind with a sunny hello. A gentleman of leisure, he's there for your pleasure, but go easy on all these, he's a love you can lose. Extraordinary fella like Mr. Punchinella. He's the kind of geezer who must never be abused. When you're in town and Ebenezer is around, you can sense the presence in the sound of the crowd. He gets them all out. The party starts rocking, the people get excited, it's quite a shout.
Was a song that somewhat clashed with the original feature that inspired it, but that was nevertheless Ebenezer Good by the Shaman from nearly 20 years ago. Well, here he is, the man in black. He's returned from the ashes, or so proclaims his T-shirt. It's What's On with Jeff Sparks.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, 2nd of July, Flipper On will be performing with support from the Disco Pirates at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8:30 p.m. and tickets are £3 in advance and £5 on the door. On Saturday, 3rd of July, Cable Co. will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Firewind. This group formed in 1998 in Greece, and to date have released 5 albums, with a 6th being released in the autumn this year. This is from the 5th album, which is titled The Premonition, and it's a track titled Mercenary Man.
Take a look at your boy. There's a man without a soul. He's standing in the doorway. I'll be gone before the night is over. Keep the faith, it's alright. Your boy's a mercenary man. A soldier made of steel. A shotgun rings. The wind is calling my name. Fields of gold beneath the blood red sky. Lost my way around in desperation. Lost the words, lost communion.
Firewind with Mercenary Man from the album The Premonition. For more information, you can check out www.firewind.gr. Moving into Sunday, 4th of July, and it's the Keynsham Music Festival at the Memorial Park, which is behind the High Street in Keynsham. Expect creative workshops, stalls, and the usual food and drink, plus entertainment from acts such as Fat Man Swings, The Kinks Controversy, and Loungefly. The event starts at 12 noon and entry is free, but donations are welcome. Finally, on Monday, 5th of July, D12 will be performing with support from the Nux at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £17.50 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on BCFM across Bristol at 12 noon every Sunday. If you're on broadband internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. You can also find us at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning, or if you're outside Bristol, you can listen live on the internet at bcfm.org.uk. Reporters this week were Tony Gosling, and our best wishes to Anthea Page on her roving travels. Studio production this week was by Michael Reed, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Thank you very much to Jess Bartz for the What's On Guide, and we'll have more fun next week. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production. Anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering, or just like to come along, please contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. I'm Dialect, and this is John Peters Common wishing you a very good week. From all the team in Queen Square Studio, goodbye.